So it's 63 BC, and it's the Day of Atonement, which is, you know, the absolute holiest day of the Jewish calendar.
Right, the most sacred day.
Exactly. The priests are inside the temple in Jerusalem. They're mid-sacrifice. The air is just thick with incense. And suddenly...
Roman soldiers.
Yes, Roman soldiers just burst through the gates. And they actually start slaughtering these priests right there at the altar.
It's just this scene of unimaginable desecration.
It really is. I mean, how did the most sacred space in Judea become this Roman bloodbath? Well, to answer that, we have to look at a pretty bitter, petty family feud.
We really do.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're immersing ourselves in the historical research of Dr. Anthony J. Tomasino, specifically his work on Judaism before Jesus and, you know, the coming of Rome.
Yeah, session 12 of his lecture series, I believe.
Right. And our mission today is to explore this really chaotic turning point in history for you. It's a moment when local leaders essentially handed the keys of Judea over to the Roman Empire, like on a silver platter.
And, you know, the scale of this transition is staggering, because the real takeaway for you listening to this is observing how these massive, sweeping geopolitical shifts, like the expansion of the Roman Republic into the Middle East, they often don't start with grand military strategy.
No, they start with drama.
Exactly, drama. They hinge on the petty personal ambitions, the sibling rivalries, and just the profound flaws of a few individuals. I mean, Rome didn't have to kick the door down. It was unlocked from the inside.
Wow. Okay, so let's unpack this vacuum of leadership that sent that invitation.
Right.
We're picking up the story with the ruling Jewish family of the era, the Hasmonean dynasty.
Right, the descendants of the Maccabees.
Yeah. So the queen, Salome, is on her deathbed, and she leaves behind this volatile succession crisis between her two sons.
It's a classic recipe for a political meltdown, honestly. You have the elder son, Heraclius, and the historical record describes him as phlegmatic.
Which is a polite way of saying passive.
Very passive. He's currently serving as the high priest, and he completely lacks that cutthroat ambition you really need to rule a turbulent kingdom.
So Heraclius basically chooses survival over ambition. He just wants to stay out of the crosshairs.
Precisely. Because on the other side, you have his younger brother, Aristobulus. And Aristobulus is aggressive, he's highly militaristic, and he desperately wants that throne.
Naturally.
Right. So he immediately raises an army and besieges Jerusalem. And Heraclius, he looks at the situation and just strikes a deal. He abdicates both the throne and the priesthood.
Just gives it up.
Just gives it up. In exchange for a quiet retirement and a comfortable pension down in the southern region of Idumea.
Okay, so he makes his peace with losing power. But then we introduce one of the most, I think, fascinating figures in this entire narrative, a man named Antipater.
Oh, Antipater is fascinating.
Right, so imagine you are Antipater for a moment. You're the governor of Idumea. You're extraordinarily wealthy, but you are an outsider.
Yeah, the Idumeans were essentially forced to convert to Judaism a generation prior, so the purists in Jerusalem really looked down on them.
Right, they don't see him as one of them. But Antipater is this brilliant political operative. He watches Heraclius arrive in Idumea, you know, perfectly content to live out his days playing golf, basically.
The ancient equivalent of golf, sure.
Yeah, exactly. And Antipater sees a golden ticket. He realizes that if he can put this passive, easily manipulated elder brother back on the throne, then Antipater can be the shadow king of Judea.
It's brilliant.
It's like a hostile corporate takeover where the ousted CEO is perfectly happy in retirement, but this shady hedge fund manager, Antipater, convinces him to launch a proxy war just so the manager can pull the strings.
That's a great way to put it. So Antipater begins this relentless campaign of psychological manipulation. He's constantly whispering in Heraclius's ear.
Feeding his paranoia.
Exactly. Asking him, do you really believe your ambitious younger brother is going to let you live? He convinces Heraclius that he is a threat as long as he's breathing.
And, I mean, he probably wasn't entirely wrong about the danger.
No, he wasn't wrong. But his solution wasn't to hide Heraclius. It was to bankroll a massive mercenary army to march on Jerusalem and take the crown back.
Okay, so Antipater and Heraclius march this mercenary force up to the gates of Jerusalem. And they lay siege to Aristobulus, who's fortified inside the Temple Mount. They hit a wall.
Literally.
Literally hit a wall. The mercenaries just cannot breach the fortifications. So in their desperation, they start looking around for a bigger hammer to break the stalemate.
And that hammer happens to be the Roman general Pompey.
Right, who is conveniently just operating in the region.
Yeah, and we really have to pause here and ask why Pompey, who is one of Rome's most formidable commanders, is even in the neighborhood. because Rome never just wandered aimlessly.
Right. They had a plan.
Their foreign policy was ruthlessly pragmatic. Pompey was originally up in Asia Minor, but he looked south towards Syria. The remnants of the old Greek Seleucid Empire were just tearing themselves apart in endless civil wars.
And Pompey saw vulnerability.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, a collapsing Syria threatens Roman trade routes, right? And regional stability.
Trade routes, yes. Mm. But beyond just trade, Rome was absolutely terrified of the Parthian Empire further east.
Oh, right. The Parthians.
Yeah, Parthia was a massive, sophisticated military superpower. And Rome desperately needed a stable buffer zone between themselves and the Parthian cavalry.
Okay, that makes sense.
So Pompey decides to absorb Syria to secure that eastern frontier. He's sitting in Damascus, calculating how to organize this new territory, when suddenly envoys from both Judean brothers show up at his camp.
Just begging him to pick a winner in their family squabble.
Exactly.
Wait, I have to push back on the Judean strategy here for a second, because looking at the historical context, the Judeans actually had this bizarre mythology that they were distant cousins with the Romans, right?
Oh, yes. The Bronze Tablet.
Yeah. And this entire belief was based on a diplomatic letter sent way back during the Maccabean era.
It is a staggering misunderstanding of international relations.
Mm-hmm.
So decades prior, Jewish leaders sent envoys to the Roman Senate looking for an ally against the Greeks.
Right.
And the Senate, you know, always happy to undermine a rival, handed them a bronze tablet that essentially said, "We are friends and allies."
But they interpreted that way too literally.
Completely. To the Judeans, a covenant was a sacred, unbreakable blood bond. To the Roman Senate, it was just standard administrative paperwork. It meant absolutely nothing the moment it wasn't politically convenient.
I mean, inviting an expansionist military superpower to settle a local family dispute based on a flimsy, decades-old "we're cousins" narrative is just incredibly naive.
It really is. And to understand the depth of that naivete, you have to look at how Roman provincial strategy had evolved. Early on, when Rome conquered Italian cities, their strategy was integration.
Like granting citizenship.
Exactly. They granted Roman citizenship, which built deep loyalty. But by 210 BC, with the island of Sicily, the policy fundamentally shifted. Sicily wasn't granted citizenship. It was designated a province.
And a province is a totally different beast. I mean, you don't get the votes. You don't get the public funds.
No, you get military governors and crippling taxation. It was no longer about camaraderie. It was about extraction and control. The only trade-off was that Rome offered absolute, uncompromising order.
Right. If you invite Rome to sort out your local troubles, they will sort them out permanently.
Usually at the tip of a sword.
Yeah. So Pompey looks at these two warring brothers, and he just tells them to wait. He says, "I'll deal with Syria first, and then I'll evaluate your claims."
Which is a reasonable response.
But Aristobulus, the aggressive younger brother, he gets paranoid. He assumes Pompey's going to rule in favor of the older brother. So he abandons the diplomatic camp, runs back to Jerusalem, and starts fortifying the city against a potential Roman attack.
Which is the one unbreakable rule of antiquity. You do not defy Rome.
Never defy Rome.
The moment Aristobulus fortifies that city, Pompey drops all his plans for Syria, pivots his entire war machine, and marches straight to Jerusalem.
And this brings us back to that chilling scene from the beginning of the deep dive. Pompey lays siege to Jerusalem, and it takes 3 months of grueling, brutal warfare.
3 months.
Yeah. Finally, in 63 BC, on the Day of Atonement, the Roman siege engines breach the temple walls. And the priests, they refuse to abandon their sacred duties. They continue the rituals as the legionaries pour in, and they're slaughtered right at the altars.
It is just a devastating cultural collision. And Pompey, displaying this profound entitlement of a conqueror, decides he's going to walk into the Holy of Holies.
Which, for you listening, understand that this is the innermost sanctuary of the temple. It's a space so sacred that only the high priest could enter it, and only on this one specific day of the year.
Right. And in the theology of the Old Testament, walking into the Holy of Holies uninvited is a guaranteed death sentence.
Like you get struck down by a lightning bolt from the divine presence.
Exactly. But Pompey just strolls in like a tourist on a sightseeing trip. He fully expects to find some grand statue or bizarre idol. Because there were rumors flying around the ancient world, some prominent Romans actually claimed the Jews worshipped a golden donkey's head in there.
A donkey's head. Wow.
Yeah. So Pompey pulls back the heavy veil, walks into the darkest, most sacred room in the world, and finds absolutely nothing.
Just an empty room.
Just an empty room. Because the God of Israel is unrepresented by physical idols. Pompey is thoroughly confused. So after this immense violation, he simply turns around, reinstalls the passive Heraclius as the high priest, and then proceeds to offer his own Roman sacrifices to the Jewish god out of this misplaced sense of respect.
Which must have horrified the religious purists even more than the siege itself. I mean, documents from the era, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, they explicitly state that accepting sacrifices from Gentiles is basically tantamount to sacrificing to demons.
Yeah, Pompey's respect was just another profound desecration.
So, with the temple secured, Pompey strips Aristobulus of all power, claps him and his sons in chains, and ships them off to Rome as prisoners of war. He leaves his trusted officer, Gabinius, in charge of Judea. And on paper, the chaos is over. Rome is in charge.
On paper, sure.
But the chaos is far from over, because Aristobulus and his sons just keep escaping from Roman custody. Like, how does a high-value prisoner of war repeatedly break out of the capital of the Roman Empire, travel all the way back to the Middle East, and raise a new army?
Well, we tend to picture Roman prisons as these inescapable subterranean dungeons. But for aristocratic political prisoners, it was often a system of house arrest.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, they were allowed to keep a small retinue of servants, receive visitors, access funds. And the late Roman Republic was famously corrupt. Guards were highly susceptible to bribery.
So they just bought their way out.
Bought their way out, or political rivals in Rome might even facilitate an escape just to cause trouble for Pompey back in the East. It was a porous system designed for leverage, not strict incarceration.
Got it. So Gabinius is stuck in Judea, repeatedly crushing these localized rebellions sparked by the escaped royals. He eventually gets so frustrated that he strips Heraclius of whatever civil power he had left and divides Judea into five completely separate administrative districts.
Just to shatter their ability to organize.
Exactly. And while Judea is fracturing, the Roman Republic itself begins to tear at the seams. The first triumvirate, which was the uneasy alliance between Pompey, Julius Caesar, and Crassus, completely collapses.
Yeah, when Crassus is killed in battle, the remaining two titans plunge Rome into a catastrophic civil war.
Generals fighting each other for ultimate supremacy.
Right. And to fund these sprawling armies, they relentlessly squeeze the provinces for every ounce of silver they could extract.
So this civil war eventually drags Julius Caesar down to Egypt. He arrives trying to settle a completely different dynastic dispute between the Egyptian king Ptolemy and his sister Cleopatra.
Ah, yes, the famous carpet story.
Yeah, this is the legendary moment where Cleopatra smuggles herself past the royal guards wrapped up inside a rug and is presented to Caesar. He decides to back her claim to the throne, but the locals in Alexandria revolt.
Right.
Suddenly, Julius Caesar, the greatest general in Rome, is trapped inside an Egyptian palace without enough troops to fight his way out.
And who is watching this unfold, calculating the odds? Antipater. Our Idumean fixer.
Of course.
He recognizes an unprecedented opportunity. If he can somehow save Julius Caesar, he will own a favor from the man poised to become the most powerful dictator on earth.
That is quite the gamble.
It is. So Antipater leverages all his wealth, gathers a formidable mercenary army, marches down into Egypt, and breaks the siege, rescuing Caesar.
Wow. And the return on that investment is astronomical. Caesar officially names Antipater the procurator of Judea, giving him the full backing of the Roman military.
But he doesn't stop there.
No, Antipater also uses this leverage to secure powerful positions for his sons. And this brings a remarkably famous name onto the stage, Herod. Antipater's son Herod is appointed the governor of Galilee, and Herod's debut is terrifying.
It really is. Almost immediately upon taking office, a local revolt breaks out in Galilee. And Herod does not simply restore order. He executes the rioters with a ruthless extrajudicial brutality that just shocks the region.
He goes so far overboard that the highest Jewish court, the Sanhedrin, actually summons him to Jerusalem to stand trial for murder.
Right. And imagine receiving a court summons, and your response is to show up to the trial flanked by a heavily armed personal militia.
It's insane. Herod walks into the Sanhedrin fully prepared to slaughter the entire jury. It's the ancient equivalent of a mob boss bringing armed thugs into a federal courtroom.
Antipater actually has to intervene. He pulls his son aside and explains, you cannot just murder the Supreme Court.
Probably good advice.
Right. He forces the Sanhedrin to quietly drop the charges, but the chilling message is sent. Herod is untouchable.
But despite the brutal rise of Herod, Antipater's alliance with Julius Caesar did actually yield one profound benefit for the broader Jewish population, didn't it?
It did. Out of gratitude, Caesar enacted legislation that made Judaism a protected, legally recognized religion across the entire Roman Empire.
Which is a brilliant piece of political compromise, because the Romans were aggressively spreading the imperial cult, setting up altars in every civic square, and demanding that citizens offer a sacrifice to the spirit of the emperor.
And if you refused, it was treason.
Right. And for a monotheistic Jew, sacrificing to a mortal emperor is absolute blasphemy.
But Caesar's law provided this brilliant loophole. Instead of demanding that Jews sacrifice to the emperor, they were legally permitted to simply offer a daily sacrifice to their own god on behalf of the emperor's health and safety.
That is so smart.
It really is. That single legal protection allowed Jewish communities to participate in the empire without violating their core theology. It saved countless lives. But of course, the stability was temporary.
Because in 44 BC, Julius Caesar is assassinated on the floor of the Senate.
The Ides of March. Instantly, the Roman world fractures again. You have Mark Antony and Cassius fighting over control of the eastern provinces.
And Mark Antony emerges victorious, and he eventually summons Cleopatra. But she doesn't use a rug this time.
Yeah, definitely not a rug.
She arrives on a massive gold-plated barge with sails woven from actual gold thread, dressed as the goddess Aphrodite.
It is a masterclass in psychological warfare. Antony was this gruff, common man soldier who had fought his way up the ranks. He is entirely mesmerized, not just by her, but by the sheer unimaginable wealth she is projecting.
Right.
But it was an illusion.
Right.
Cleopatra had essentially bankrupted the Egyptian treasuries to put on that spectacle. They were entirely out of money.
Wait, really? Cleopatra emptied her entire national treasury just to impress Mark Antony? That's an insane gamble. Somebody had to foot the bill for that lifestyle.
And that somebody was the provinces. Mark Antony imposes crushing extortionate taxes on Judea to fund his Egyptian ambitions.
Yeah.
And while the economy is being suffocated, the political situation in Judea completely unspools.
It just falls apart.
Yeah. In 43 BC, the great puppet master, Antipater, is finally poisoned to death by his rivals.
Oh.
And seeing the mastermind gone, the last remnants of the Hasmonean royals see an opening to take their country back. Antigonus, the son of the aggressive brother Aristobulus, does the unthinkable. He allies with the Parthian Empire.
Rome's greatest enemy.
Exactly. He promises the Parthians a staggering amount of silver to invade Judea, crush the Roman-backed government, and install him as king. And the Parthians are more than happy to do it because it allows them to bloody Rome's nose without fighting the main legions.
So in 40 BC, the Parthian cavalry sweeps into Jerusalem, and the fallout is just visceral and gruesome. Antigonus captures his uncle, Heraclius, the passive older brother, who abdicated decades ago to avoid this exact scenario.
Right.
And Antigonus physically mutilates him, cutting off his uncle's ears.
It sounds like pure barbarism, but it was actually a highly calculated political maneuver.
Yeah.
Ancient Jewish law required the high priest to be physically unblemished.
Oh, wow.
By intentionally mutilating his ears, Antigonus ensured that his uncle could never legally hold the high priesthood again. He permanently eliminated him as a rival.
That is so incredibly dark. Meanwhile, Antipater's other son, Fezzel, is captured by the Parthians. And knowing the horrific torture that awaits him, Fezzel commits suicide in his cell by bashing his own head against a stone wall.
Just brutal.
Herod is the only one who manages to escape the bloodbath. He flees into the desert, eventually making his way to Rome to beg for an army to take his country back.
You know, if you pause and put yourself in the shoes of the average Judean living through this, the tragedy is immense.
Absolutely.
You don't care about Cleopatra's gold barge or the political maneuvering of the Roman Senate. All you know is that these sweeping geopolitical romances and elite ambitions are trickling down to you as crushing taxes, sudden foreign invasions, and brutal proxy wars fought in your streets. The common people pay the ultimate price for the ambitions of a dozen elites.
Yeah. And as the Hasmonean dynasty gasps its dying breaths, eventually replaced entirely by Herod and his descendants, we have to look back at their legacy, because this family didn't start out as corrupt politicians.
So they didn't.
They started out as the heroes of the Maccabean Revolt. They were the zealous freedom fighters who threw off the Greek Seleucid Empire to save their religion from being wiped out.
True. And some historians try to argue that the Hasmoneans saved Judaism from extinction. But the historical record shows that it's a profound overstatement.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there were thriving, vibrant Jewish communities in Egypt, in Parthia, and in Greece that were doing just fine. What the Hasmoneans saved was a very specific, temple-centric, Jerusalem-based brand of political Judaism.
Okay, I see.
And to maintain the absolute power required to protect it, they compromised nearly every religious principle they originally went to war for.
Right. Like, they started a holy war over strict religious purity, But the moment they secured power, the rules just evaporated. They fought battles on the Sabbath when it suited them. They usurped the high priesthood from the Zadokites, which is the one specific family lineage that was legally ordained to hold that title for centuries. And then they crowned themselves kings, completely ignoring the ancient biblical promise that only someone descended from the line of King David could sit on the throne. They simply decided that whoever held the swords got to wear the crowns.
When you look at their historical trajectory, it's hard not to think of George Orwell's Animal Farm.
Oh, that's a great comparison.
Right. The animals lead a righteous, bloody rebellion to overthrow the cruel human farmers, seeking to establish a utopia based on absolute equality. But slowly, inevitably, the pigs who emerge as the leaders start adopting the exact behaviors of the humans in order to maintain control.
All animals are equal, but some are more equal than others.
Exactly. And the chilling final scene of that book perfectly mirrors the Hasmonean dynasty. The other animals look through the farmhouse window. They look from the pigs to the humans and from the humans back to the pigs, and they realize they can no longer tell the difference. By the end of their reign, the Hasmoneans had taken Greek names, hired Greek mercenaries, and adopted the exact same opulent, tyrannical trappings of power as the Hellenistic kings they had originally fought to expel.
I mean, they invited an expansionist empire into their home just to settle a petty family dispute. And in doing so, they traded their hard-won independence for a Roman master that would eventually burn their temple to the ground.
It's a tragic irony.
It really is. Which brings us to our final thought for you to mull over today. As you trace this family's transition from zealous heroes to indistinguishable tyrants, it forces you to question the very nature of power. Does the sheer practical necessity of political survival always corrupt ideological purity?
That's the big question.
When a righteous movement finally gains the absolute power it needs to protect itself, is it simply destined to become the very monster it originally fought to destroy? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the narratives of history, and we'll see you next time.